everyone, welcome back to Who's There. I'm your host, as always, Allison. If you're new here, thank you for joining us. This is a podcast where I talk to a new horror fan every week because I hope to destigmatize what it means to be a horror movie fan, because most of us, we're just regular people who like the adrenaline rush of being scared for some reason, and here we delve into those reasons. I hope you're all enjoying October still and doing a lot of spooky things. This week, I have a conversation to share with you that I knew had to be released during the month of October. This week, I'm speaking with horror fan and writer Alfonso Zapata. We talk in depth about the Halloween franchise, a franchise that I admittedly don't know a lot about, and we specifically talk a lot about Halloween 6, or rather, Alfonso does, because he knows so much about it. We also talk about the Druid Curse and the Curse of Thorn, all of which I knew nothing about. I learned so much about Michael Myers and Halloween in this conversation, it almost made me want to go back and rewatch, you know, the movies that I've seen. But not quite yet. But you might want to, because everything he brings up is so interesting. I know you're going to learn a ton. As always, please take a second to rate and review us wherever you listen to us. And let's get into my conversation with Alfonso Zapata. Hey, Alfonso, how are you?
I'm just fine. How about yourself, Allison?
I'm good, thanks. Do you want to start by telling everyone a little bit about yourself and why you're here?
Yeah, so I'm from a small town in Washington State originally, and I live here in Richmond, Virginia now. I've been here for about a year since I graduated from graduate school at Virginia Tech. I'm here because over the last 3 years, I've kind of gone down a rabbit hole with horror films, specifically with the Halloween franchise with Michael Myers.
Awesome. So first things first, what's your favorite scary movie?
It would be Halloween 6, The Curse of Michael Myers, the producer's cut version.
That is very specific and very unique. I love it. We'll get into that in a little while, but how did you first fall in love with the horror genre?
I think it was because growing up, my late mother, she's now passed, but she was really into horror films. When I was growing up, just kind of had a passing interest, you know. I mean, I would watch one or two with her, but it kind of really developed when I started to go to graduate school in 2020. It was during the pandemic. It was over Zoom. It was virtual. I actually, for some reason, I thought about Halloween with Michael Myers, and I had met a cohort member of mine at the time when we were both going to graduate school in the same program. He was also into horror, and I one day kind of asked him after class, kind of texted him after class was over about, hey, you know, what do you think about a supernatural explanation for Michael Myers' powers? And that was kind of a little bit explored in Halloween 6, the theatrical, but I think it was also more fully explored in the producer's cut version. He kind of shut me down. He believed, you know, it sort of demystifies his character because he believes it kind of, it's more scary when there's no backstory motivation. I disagree. I think it's a case-by-case scenario, but during that time at Tech, we kind of had that debate back and forth, and that's where my love for Halloween and Michael Myers grew, was to really study the backstory and watch the producer's cut. I had heard about it before, of it. It is a controversial entry to the franchise, and I watched all the movies in order from the original film, including Halloween 3, which I know has nothing to do with Michael Myers since it was supposed to be originally an anthology series, but fans demanded him back. But I watched it, and then I watched the producer's cut of 6, and it made total sense that it explains so much about his power and why. I mean, it also answers why he kept coming back, why he can't kill him. I mean, that explicit supernatural explanation. I mean, yeah, they kind of hint at it with Chucky, Freddy Krueger, yeah. But the backstory with Michael, I felt, with the Druid Curse, it really kind of honed in that and also explained a lot of inconsistencies or plot holes from the original film, and such as, you know, how did he escape from Smith's Grove that night? I mean, a lot of casual fans of the Halloween franchise don't really question that night when Dr. Loomis is coming to pick him up, to take him to court. And I think, you know, it totally makes sense that he had a guardian. He had somebody on the inside of Smith's Grove. It turned out to be Dr. Terrence Wynn, who was he made a minor appearance in the first film with Loomis when they had an interaction after Michael escaped about how could this happen. And, you know, Wynn just kind of brushes Loomis's concern aside, saying, how that he can't even drive a car. And Loomis responds, interesting enough, well, he was doing very well last night. Maybe someone around here gave him lessons. And that was a lot closer to the truth in the backstory that I've subscribed to. But yeah.
Very cool. I have to admit, I think I've only seen up to the fourth Halloween movie. It's not a franchise that I've spent a lot of time watching, but I read your article that you read for Histora that you wrote for Histora fans, and it was really interesting. So we'll get into that in a little while. But why do you think that people who seem perfectly sane love the horror genre?
I would say there are a multitude of reasons, and I think your podcast is a great platform to kind of help destigmatize the genre because for too long it's kind of been seen as one-dimensional, as slicing and dicing and gore. And for me, how I approach it is kind of more nuanced. It's storytelling potential, and I think that's what horror can be, just like any other genre, like science fiction or fantasy, like Star Wars or, for example, or Lord of the Rings. For me, I think there's multiple reasons I understand the fright factor or how people are going to get out of this scary situation or these impossible odds within in those circumstances depicted in horror against the monster or killer. But I think there's a lot of different reasons. For me, like I said, it's the world building, the lore, the potential for kind of going in depth with it to give more nuance, to have a universe like its own kind of lore, basically.
Nice. So, what scares you in horror movies and in real life?
I would say what scares me in horror movies is that the jump scares for in some movies I've watched. I mean, I'm gonna be honest, like I've watched some horror films like the when I it's been a while, but I've seen The Conjuring. And whenever there was like a part I felt because of the music, the change in the music, I just literally just turned down the volume because of like, I don't want to hear this jump scare. Like, I'm just gonna turn mute it because I know it's coming. Because that kind of startles me. If somebody kind of comes out of nowhere, a killer or monster, what have you. What kind of scares me in real life is the fact that we still have nuclear weapons that are still available in the world today. That's very
Yeah,
scary.
it is. Can I just ask, what did you end up getting your graduate degree in?
It was a master's degree in history.
Nice. What's your favorite subgenre in horror?
Good question. I think I don't know if Alien would the Alien franchise would classify like the Alien subgenre,
Yeah, Aliens is a
with the
sci-fi.
xenomorphs. Yes, sci-fi, science fiction, fantasy.
Nice.
Yeah, mostly. Yeah, so that'd be my favorite.
Oh, nice. Do you have any favorite horror directors?
John Carpenter, because he created the icon. He created Michael Myers. He really had a he knew what he had on his hands. And I would also say Guillermo del Toro. I kind of like his stuff as well. Pan's Labyrinth. That was a very beautifully done film that could use a sequel, but I know people debate that as well. So,
Yeah. So you wrote an article called Evil Will Be Unmasked. Halloween, Michael Myers, The Druids, and the Power of History in the Horror Film Genre. And it was all about the connections between the Druids and history and how it's interwoven into all of the Halloween sequels. So, can you talk a little bit more about that?
yeah, so for the purposes of kind of entertainment, yeah, they kind of stretch the historical accuracy for the Druids, but Halloween, the holiday that we know and love today, especially in the United States, derives from the Celtic festival of Samhain. That is how you pronounce it, Samhain. And kind of from there, centuries four later, kind of evolved into this holiday of trick-or-treating, jack-o'-lanterns, dressing up in costumes and what have you, kind of where the Druids tie in. And I think the screenwriter for Halloween 6, Daniel Ferrans is his name, really did his homework was the human sacrifice angle, which in the backstory, in the Druid curse backstory for Michael, that is his motivation. That is why he's after Laurie Strode, played by Jamie Lee Curtis, and later Daniel Harris's character, Jamie Lloyd, in 5 and 6, that the Druids in real life, they believe in that maintaining a sense of equilibrium with nature. And the way to do that was through sacrifices. They would sacrifice criminals or those who breached their sacred law. And I know for purposes for the Halloween backstory, they kind of exaggerate a little bit for entertainment purposes, but it's kind of the parallels are there that, the murders that Michael committed across the original franchise were part of ritualistic human sacrifices for Thor to stave off terrible calamities like disease, famine, war, or what have you. And the Druids, we don't know much about them because they did not leave primary source documents, written words. What kind of we have is kind of secondary sources, from people like Julius Caesar, who talks about the human sacrifice component, but some kind of archaeologists and scholars think he kind of exaggerate a little bit because he kind of depicts him a little bit as bloodthirsty. But yeah, the idea of balance to the natural world, and also the Druids were kind of a high class within Celtic society that they believed, that there was like a connection to the spiritual, supernatural, or supernatural realm, to the real world, which I think is also a great added thing to the Curse of Thorns storyline.
Can you explain for anyone who's not familiar with it what the Curse of Thorn storyline is in the Halloween movies?
Yes, so basically in Halloween 6, I'm gonna make two distinctions. The theatrical cut kind of talks about it a little bit, but it's basically the Curse of Thorn was a Druid curse that had selected a child of a Celtic tribe to murder their family on the evening of Samhain or Halloween, and in order to appease the demon Thorn, to maintain the idea of balance, to stave off like disasters and the like, because that's what the Druids believed in, that they needed to appease this demon. And so in six, Tommy Doyle's character, he's played by Paul Rudd. I think he did a fantastic performance. Tommy Doyle was briefly seen in the first film as one of the kids Laurie was babysitting that night, that Michael was stalking the streets, that he pieces it together that the power of Thorn is what gives Michael life, makes him keep going, with how he was able to survive the hospital explosion scene at the end of Halloween 2 to come back from that. But essentially, he was the chosen one for the Druids, that he had in that kind of little bit backtrack on in the original film. On that night he kills his sister Judith in 1963, he essentially was fulfilling the prophecy to kill his entire family, or supposed to. Of course, he only killed his sister, and then he ended up getting locked up in Smith's Grove and was able to finish job with his mom or dad or Laurie at that time. But no, that apparently with the Druid curse, there's a symbol. It's a rune symbol called Thorn. Coincidentally enough, that it is on Michael's wrist is what it was revealed in Halloween 5. He's in the opening of that film. He's sort of in a little bit of a coma or comatose state. This hermit sort of kind of keeping him there because this was after the events of 4, where he kind of falls down a mine shaft and goes down the river, and you see this mysterious Thorn's tattoo on his wrist. And basically, it is also explained that with the curse, there's a constellation in the night sky of the Thorn symbol. And that kind of explains Michael's movements across the original franchise, always coming after his family on Halloween, specifically on Halloween night. That
Oh.
once the prophecy is fulfilled, the curse will be passed on to another child to begin the cycle all over again, as the Druids believed or as they practiced.
Oh, wow. So, but why did he need to kill Lori? Because Lori's not really related to him unless you're going by the lore that says that she is his sister. So is that what you're relating to?
Yes, I'm going by the revelation of Halloween 2. So
Yeah.
kind of the backstory that I'm using to really support my argument, takes the first movie, the second movie, the fourth and fifth films, and the producer's cut of 6, because the theatrical version of 6 only it deals with Thorn stuff a little bit, but there's an alternate ending in that version where Dr. Wynn was just revealed to be like this pseudo guardian that was part of this pseudo cult to just exploit Michael's supernatural healing abilities for medical purposes. And I was just left totally dumbfounded. I was like, what the heck? Like, all that kind of build off of the potential was, for me, it was taken away. It was ruined in the theatrical version for 6. And there's kind of a long story about the fight that the screenwriter Daniel Ferrans had with Dimension Films, which held the rights to Halloween at the time, that he was pushing hard for the Thorn backstory. And to my understanding, since I've watched some special feature interviews from some of the recent kind of Blu-ray releases from Scream Factory, about from the latest their Blu-ray and 4K editions of the Halloween franchise, that he they did a test screening for Six, and apparently it was the producer's cut version, and it was amongst a young audience of teenagers and young adults, but they did not receive it very well. So they went back to the drawing board. You know, the Weinsteins decided, oh, we want more gore, we want more of this, kind of going with the slasher genre, and that's what happened. And but the thing is, of course, the theatrical version of Halloween Six is a little bit messy because Michael's mask is just seen on the floor. You hear Dr. Loomis screaming in the background, no context, and the film ended. And because of that ending, I think that's why they had to reboot the franchise first time with H2O, bringing back Jamie Lee Curtis. But I am going by the original timeline of, like I said, the first movie, second, fourth, and fifth film, and six films, but the producer's cut of six.
Oh, that's really interesting. So were there's Halloween through Halloween 6 and then comes Halloween H2O? Is that,
Yes.
yeah.
Yes. Halloween
Okay.
H2O was released in 1998, 20 years later, after the first one by John Carpenter. And it's kind of interesting that him and his co-creator, Deborah Hill, well, for John Carpenter, I know, he originally intended it to be a one and done film for the first movie. He never intended there to be a franchise with Michael Myers. And he is, I would love to meet him one day. I would. But I know he's notorious for not giving his opinions of any of the sequels, even including the recent trilogy, to fans. He just leaves it up to the fans to decide for themselves what to think of the films. But yeah, it is a very interesting story, you know, that I guess, yeah, that I just love the idea that the first movie, you know, you just think that he's just this babysitter killer on Halloween night stalking these teenagers. But with Six, the producer cut, it does a 180 on his character. It recontextualizes the first film, and I love it. It kind of changes, it changes so much how I see, how I perceive the first film. And I love that.
That's really interesting. So the producer's cut has the ending is the cop or detective. Who is he telling about the curse, the druid curse?
Oh, so Tommy Doyle originally tells a character named Kara Strode, who is related to Laurie, because she's from the family that adopted Laurie to keep her away from Michael after he was incarcerated at Smith's Grove. That Tommy Doyle's the one that pieced it together. And then there's like a climactic final scene at Smith's Grove. Very fitting place to set that final confrontation, where Dr. Loomis is confronting his friend, his colleague, Dr. Wynn, who tells him, you know, the time has come for you know to know the truth. And I love that line. That and then I also love the fact that when you could tell he's very passionate about the role he plays as Michael's guardian, that he's like, I protect Michael, watch over him. And I guess what I will say with that is it is very rare in the horror film genre to see a guardian of some kind protecting the killer or the monster. I mean, yeah, we in Friday the 13th, there's Jason's mom, but we did not really see them interact side by side. The only kind of thing where you see that happen is in Freddy versus Jason in the dream sequence, where Freddy is disguised as Jason's mother, telling him to go to Springfield, Ohio, to kill these teenagers on Elm Street. But with Dr. Wynn, you know, another reason what makes him stand out for me is the fact that he was a seemingly unimportant character, and he later came back to be revealed to be the overarching antagonist of the franchise. And for me, it made total sense. It worked, and I loved that. He's the one that protected him, taught him how to do. It also explains how was Michael able to drive if he was incarcerated since he was 6 years old? Well, it was Dr. Wynn that taught him. And then, yes.
Wow. So, what was the ending that everyone got in the theatrical release, and how is it different?
So in the theatrical release, what happens is that Tommy Doyle goes to rescue Kara because she's taken by this pseudo cult of Thorn. They're not the real version. They're just pretenders at Smith's Grove. She is kept there. And on his way to rescue her inside the sanitarium, he encounters, you know, this one of the mental patients who's been stabbed by Michael. Apparently, he's on a rampage. And he comes face to, when he's rescuing Kara again around the room, she's kept locked in. He kind of finally comes face to face once again with Michael after so many years, you know, like he remembers him when he was 8 years old and traumatized as a child, seeing him when Laurie was up the stairs at the house. Yeah. And he proceeds to take Kara and run. But they, during their escape, were to get Kara's son, Danny, the young boy, and what was later to be revealed, Michael's child, because they had an incest storyline in there, that he, there was a massacre in the operating room because Dr. Wynn appears with some of the cult members, and they think because they're onto something kind of groundbreaking, because they've kind of experimented a little bit with Michael's supernatural abilities over the years. They go into this operating room and they work on this kind of new procedure. And then Michael, he, on his way to look for Tommy and Kara, he eventually settles to go after his pseudo mentor and guardian, Dr. Wynn. I mean, how dare you, Michael? That guy was the one that he guided you. That he goes into the operating room, he grabs this large knife blade, the machete, and he begins hacking everybody in that operating room. And a lot of fans think that he's one of the most ruthless Michaels in any of the installments in that version, the theatrical version of Six. There's like a lot of bloodshed, and you know what happens is he massacres everybody. One person manages to escape, but he kills them, and then he comes after Danny, Kara, the baby, and Tommy. But Tommy's able to get Michael close to inject him with some of those tranquilizers and beat him up with a pipe. And so it ends with Michael beaten. Dr. Loomis is nowhere to be seen. And at the end, it kind of shows a ma Michael's mask on the floor, and assuming he got up and he disappeared. And you know, like I said, Dr. Loomis's voice is screaming in the distance without no context. That is kind of how it differs from the producer's cut version. The producer's cut, you know, is showing a sacrificial ceremony that Dr. Wynn is helping to officiate, that Kara is on the sacrificial altar for Danny to kill his mom. So right after Michael kills the last member of his family, which was this child, to finally pass on the curse to the next person, which was Danny Strode, to begin the cycle all over again. But of course, Tommy Doyle comes in to save the day. He infiltrates the cult by disguising himself as one of the members. He puts a blade to Dr. Wynn's neck, and Dr. Wynn orders Kara to be released, and Michael gives chase to Tommy and them, and Tommy uses runestones to cancel out the powers of evil within Michael. And Michael's evil stopped because Tommy says the word Samhain. And he does also a ceremony on the floor with the runestones by cutting his hand with a blade to put blood on the floor, I guess, to kind of make that the final sacrifice on behalf of Thorne to also make Michael finally stop. And he does. And what happens is Dr. Loomis stays behind. He goes to find a fallen Michael, but it's later revealed to be Dr. Wynn in the Michael Myers mask and coveralls, because Michael knocked him out. And he proceeded to take his own outfit, the black duster and fedora. And he just walks away in this dark hallway. And it's left a little bit ambiguous because there was a lot more that the screenwriter wanted to do, but Dementia Films wasn't happening. But that is the ending of the producer's cut. So there's quite a bit of difference
Yeah.
between both cuts.
Wow. So you say that in Halloween 2, it gives context and foreshadows the Druid curse backstory. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So in Halloween 2, Dr. Loomis is looking for Michael because even though it's called Halloween 2, it's supposed to be set in the same night as the first movie. Michael, of course, after he shot him six times, Michael escaped. He disappears, right? And Dr. Loomis fo follows a lead with the Haddonfield sheriff to a elementary school, where there he goes inside. They find in one of the classrooms a knife sticking through a desk, through a drawing of a family, right through the picture of a stick figure of what's supposed to be a young girl, and it has the word sister on it. And on the chalkboard is the word Samhain in blood. And so it's kind of already giving the foreshadow of what's to come in Six. I think it's a great inspiration for what's to come in Six, for what the screenwriter Daniel Ferrans had in mind. But then he's summoned back to Smith's Grove by the governor of Illinois, because Nurse Chambers, who was with Loomis the night Michael escaped, comes back and brings him back. And when he's riding with her potentially to go back to Smith's Grove, he kind of talks about, you know, a little bit about the Druids believing that they could predict the future by doing these sacrifices and sacrificing animals and humans and putting blood in baskets, and that they could that they were like omens to the future. And he kind of makes a great commentary that, you know, Halloween isn't just, and to extension Samhain, isn't just goblins and witches, you know, that he thinks that there's more to it, that it's like darkness within our very souls. And that's very deep, because I mean, he's a psychiatrist, so it makes sense. But right there, you get a little bit of the hint of the prelude to the Druid stuff in six. And I think another inspiration is probably, you know, Halloween three, the anthology of Cochrane with the masks, and believing in a worldwide sacrifices to have equilibrium and balance. But for Dr. Wynn and the Druids and the Druid cult of Thorn, they believe the sacrifice of an entire family was sufficient enough. So there's like that schism, but that's a whole different story. But we won't count three because it's not part of the timeline as much as, at least with Michael Myers, because it's a standalone film.
Wow, I've learned so much about the Halloween franchise in this conversation because I don't know a lot about it because I find it a little slow and boring, but now I can go back to it and rewatch it with this new appreciation. So I appreciate you doing that for me. My last question about Halloween is, do you think David Gordon Green's Halloween trilogy has anything to do with the Druid's curse?
That is a good question. You know, I mean, talk about the controversy of Halloween 6. His trilogy is also controversial, especially how it ended. You know, Halloween Ends, I saw it last year in theaters. He made a lot of homages throughout his trilogy to, you know, one, two, and three, especially with the opening title credits and the fonts that were used and other kind of homages throughout his films. But I do know the novelization for Halloween Kills. It talks about Tommy Doyle wearing a tattoo of the rune stone, the thorn symbol. So it's kind of a little bit of an Easter egg, if you will. But I think, you know, with his trilogy, it kind of flirted a little bit with about being supernatural, because at the end of Kills, you know, Laurie, when she's in the hospital, says every time Michael kills, he ascends. So that kind of flirts with the idea of him being supernatural. But the problem with, I mean, not from my kind of perspective, he kind of didn't really get the sense of whether or not he was trying to make Michael supernatural or just a human being. And of course, well, never, I mean, unless you directly ask him and he gives you the answer, it kind of wasn't, I wasn't really sure either way, because he kind of flirted with it a little bit and Kills, thought he was going to expand on that ends. It didn't happen that way. I mean, I guess in a way you could say, right, because the new kid, Corey, right, that he takes on, he wears the Michael mask and he effectively becomes Michael Myers. And so I guess you could say Michael Myers isn't a person specifically. He is this like idea, this boogeyman, and that Corey apparently just happened to don the mask for a little bit in Ends, because yeah, he believed he had this kind of connection to Michael as an outcast. But it's a whole different story. But I think that for me, there was just Easter eggs. There wasn't anything, fortunately, there's nothing definitive in his trilogy to support that.
That's super interesting. So, back to other horror movies. An article came out in 2020 that said that horror movie fans were handling lockdown better than non-horror movie fans. Why do you think that was the case?
I think because maybe horror fans kind of have seen scenarios like with these movies to be like, you know, scary, how are these very stressful situations, and like how are they going to get out of it, that they're kind of used to stress, I guess, seeing very stressful situations and enjoying those kind of films, I guess, as a coping mechanism, you know, like to consider, you know, weren't during the COVID era lockdowns, that they didn't see that much of as a barrier, I guess, that they didn't really see that as much of a hindrance for them. At least that's my opinion, that it helped them to cope with it by watching those movies, because
Are
they love those movies.
there any horror movies that you won't watch or that you won't watch ever again?
Oh yeah, that's kind of hard. But the Jack Frost film, not with Michael Keaton, the other, the one where he's the killer snowman, only because I remember every time I watch it, I'm like, oh, this is so over the top. Like, no, but I will say, with that, the Human Centipede, never, never again. Like that is where I draw a line. That kind of body horror, no, I can't. Like that is too much for me. The Human Centipede trilogy, especially the first film.
I've never watched it, so I probably never will. Have you ever had any noteworthy experiences seeing a horror movie in theaters?
Yes, it was Halloween Kills when I saw
Yeah.
that in theaters on in the big screen. And then also I saw Halloween, I guess the original Hall, that not the original, the 2018 Halloween with my mother. That was a very memorable experience, especially how that film ended. That was
Nice.
one of fond memories I have with her.
No. What has been your favorite horror movie so far that you've seen in 2023?
That's a good question. I would say, can it be anything?
Yeah.
Any okay. There was a, I don't know, I watched this one, I forgot what it's called specifically, but it's about like giant killer ants overtaking like the small town. I think it was like in Florida or something. It was like a couple decades ago. I can't remember what it was specifically, but it ended very bizarrely. I was like, yeah, there was kind of radioactive or giant killer ants.
Empire
It,
of the Ants.
yes, that film. Yes. That film. I was very intrigued by that. That was like, oh my gosh, like I haven't really watched much insect horror films, but that one was very, I thought it was good.
Nice. What horror movie are you most looking forward to seeing that's being released in the rest of 2023?
The next Insidious, oh, I think that one already came out, the last
Yeah.
Insidious film. I can't remember the name of it, but it looks like it from the trailer looked pretty good. That is kind of blanking on me right now about what. Oh, Saw X, yeah, that one. Saw
Nice.
X to see what that one's all about again for his story, Jigsaw story.
Are there any horror movies that you love that people generally don't like?
Yes. Yes, there are.
Which one?
Like I said, Halloween 6, the producer's cut. Alien 2. I know some people probably don't like that, but I do. Another one I would say is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the 2003 version.
Okay.
That had a very interesting take on the character.
Yeah. If you could remake one horror movie, which one would it be?
The first Halloween film.
Why?
I would try to introduce the Thorn stuff early on in that first movie if I was able to remake it.
Oh, nice. Do you have any idea of how you would do it?
Kind of give the hints of the Thorn tattoo on Michael's wrist and have Dr. Loomis maybe kind of in his office kind of questioning, you know, the night of his cap of his escape and looking over his file again, maybe looking overlooking something he missed and kind of realize, you know, somebody must have let him out intentionally, let the patients out intentionally. And then more scenes with Dr. Wynn. Yes, more scenes with Dr. Wynn.
All right, awesome. So my final question is, if you had to spend quarantine with one horror villain, who would it be?
Dr. Terrence Wynn.
Is he a
Michael's
villain?
guardian.
Is he a villain? I guess
It
in the
depends on,
producer's cut.
yes, he's the overarching antagonist in the
Yeah.
producer's cut, yes, of the series, of the franchise. Yes,
Mm.
I would love to hang out with Michael's guardian.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for being here. Do you want to tell everyone where they can find you and your writing?
Yeah, so I am on Instagram, Alfonso Savala. I am kind of hopefully eventually within the next year or so going to work up my own kind of personal website, but you can check out my article, Historifans' upcoming article, as Allison mentioned, about evil will be unmasked, hopefully by Halloween of this year, on their website, historifans.org. And you can just get a hold of me on Instagram if you're interested in chatting more about the Druid Curse Baxter or Michael Myers or anything Halloween related.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
All right, well, thank you, Allison. It was a pleasure to be on your podcast. I really appreciate it.
That's it for this week's episode of Who's There. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Alfonso Zapata, and thanks again to Alfonso for coming on. I'll leave links to his socials in the show notes in case you want to continue the conversation about Halloween 6. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Who's There PC, and if you have any questions, comments, concerns, horror movie recommendations, or you'd like to be a guest, shoot us an email at whostherepc@gmail.com. Let me know what you're doing for the Halloween season on socials. I want to hear all about it. Maybe give me some inspiration. Until next time, stay scary and never ask who's there.